accession number 10723, reel 3.
Captain Land, reel 3.
The first place we touched down was an RAF operated field, airfield, and the officers' mess was in traditional local style, but the Americans brought with them entire hotel equipped to cater for the constant flow of travellers east and west between the Middle East, where the fighting was going on, and the American continent. However, we flew on there to Washington, and after a few days briefing, flew on westward to Honolulu, where Admiral Nimitz had his headquarters for the Pacific War.
Can you tell me how the American Navy in those days compared with the Royal Navy and their methods from your own personal impressions at Honolulu?
Well, I think one of the feelings uppermost in my mind would be that I was impressed with their readiness to learn and discuss. I've mentioned earlier that we were, in the British Navy, were thinking up methods of using the information available to us from radar and building it into the ship's systems. I was able to discuss with Admiral Nimitz's staff what we had been doing in the Eastern Fleet, where we'd had more time to start doing this because we had no active operations. The Admiral Nimitz's staff were most receptive to our ideas, and in the few weeks that I was away from Pearl Harbor, having been down to the South Pacific and back, they had already gotten experimental equipment fitted in one of their ships. So, ready to learn, quick to act. I thought they were most impressive in that particular way. Secondly, I was most favorably impressed by Admiral Nimitz, who saw us all, even a mere lowly commander. He was willing to spend some time to talk. I flew down to the South Pacific.
Just before you leave Honolulu, yes, could I ask you if you were shown the remains of the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor whilst you were on Hawaii?
Not in detail, no. As to see the results of Japanese action later on when I got down to the South Pacific, and they weren't particularly keen, I don't think, to show off their sad remains of their fleet at Pearl Harbor.
You were saying you then went to the South Pacific?
This transportation was by the U.S. Naval Air Transport System. One small point of interest on the way down. One of the stopping places organized by the Americans was on a British island. I'm not sure which one, I think, but probably Christmas. And There was a lone, solitary Englishman living in a hut with one water pipe run from the Americans' camp as a modern comfort. I suppose maintaining British sovereignty over this far-flung island with large numbers of Americans, large numbers of American airplane landing and taking off every day. He had to be there.
As a symbolic presence.
As a symbolic presence. It struck me as being almost the nadir of upholding one's country. Awful job. However, when I got down to the South Pacific, I was sent by the Americans, appointed to USS Northampton, which was equivalent to our Washington-class cruisers built during the interwar years. 8-inch guns, 10,000 tons, or thereabouts. And the captain made me comfortable by lending me his day cabin and retiring to his sea cabin, which was in the bridge structure. So I was comfortably housed. And shortly after I got there, written orders were received for an operation to take place about a week ahead to intercept Japanese reinforcements being ferried down into Guadalcanal from Rabaul, which was their main base.
I think it was at this time that you were sunk, were you not?
Yes. A force of four sister ships of the USS Northampton with four destroyers was sent up to intercept a Japanese force of several destroyers. The idea being to catch them just before they landed their passengers and cargo on the northern beaches of the island. Unfortunately, the timing was such that our force must have been silhouetted against the rising moon, because shortly after we established radar contact with the Japanese force, we saw torpedo wakes approaching the ship from the port bow, and the Northampton was hit by two, and she burst burst into flames.
Where were you at the time?
I was on the bridge alongside the captain, and I saw the torpedo tracks myself, but being after dark, one didn't see them until they were too close, and evading action was not effective. It seems that the ship was hit in or about the diesel fuel tanks. Certainly the communication was lost between the bridge and the after turrets, and so one had to rely on the officers at the after end of the ship taking the appropriate action for abandoning ship or what. After a relatively short time, the ship heeled over, and that meant that the boiler room fans were no longer able to go because they were designed for operating in an upright state. And once the boiler room fans had to be stopped, the ship soon lost power and lost, therefore, the power to fight fires or anything else. I mentioned the division of the ship into two because, to my mind, it was indicative of good discipline that the people at the after end of the ship, which must have been getting very hot, did not abandon the ship until they had instructions to do so, and thereby saved many lives, because this was in the dead of night. The ship had been steaming at 20 knots, so that even though the engines were not working, she was still passing through the water. And if there hadn't been good discipline, many people would have been lost through just being away from the bulk and the body. As it was, I think that the people on the after end of the ship were probably 2 miles away from where the ship finally sank, and say it would have been at hazard for being lost unless they had kept together. The ship took about an hour to sink, I would guess, and the destroyers who had been acting as our screen then returned from having chased the Japanese destroyer force away, and we were picked up with a loss of only about 100 lives out of the 900 crew, which, considering the damage that was inflicted and the circumstances, was highly creditable.
Was it a Japanese destroyer that had torpedoed you, or a submarine?
At the time, it was not obvious where the torpedoes came from. But later discussion, I think, established quite clearly that it was torpedoes from the Japanese destroyer force that hit us. And that they had the advantage over the American, over us, in that they could see us against the moonlight, whereas we could only see them with our radar.
So you didn't end up in the sea yourself?
Oh, yes.
How long were you in the sea?
I would think about half an hour. I should have mentioned earlier on, when we were discussing our briefing at Admiral Nimitz's staff in Pearl Harbor, there was a Commander Lang appointed there as British naval representative on Admiral Nimitz's staff as a liaison officer, and he had been out there for some while, and he'd been on board the Yorktown aircraft carrier when she was sunk, and he said, "I'll give you a free greatest and for nothing two bits of advice if you go down to the South Pacific. One is, if you are sunk, keep your hat on, because you can't buy a British scrambled eggs hat west of Washington. And the other thing is, if you have to abandon ship, make sure that every piece of line or whatever you go down on is long enough to reach the sea, because when he abandoned ship from the Yorktown, he went over the side and his bit of rope finished 50 foot before he got down to sea level, so he had to abandon ship by air."
What's a scrambled egg hat?
A commander's hat. You know,
have gold braid
on the brim.
So how did you end up in the sea? Can you describe it?
I finished up in the sea one ahead of the admiral, of Captain Kitts, who was the captain of the Northampton.
So you were the last but one off?
I was the last but one off. And we went down the paravane chains, which are chains leading from the forefoot of the ship up onto the deck for the streaming of paraffins, which are an anti-mine device. And I knew that that would be going right to the bottom of the ship, and so I was taking the second bit of advice.
Were you able to swim?
Oh, yes. There was a third bit of advice which came not from Major Lang, but from general instructions in the South Pacific Force, that if you do have to abandon ship in the South Pacific, don't lose your shoes, because if you haven't got something on your feet when you get ashore over coral, you'll have your feet cut to bits. And so I remember to take my shoes off, put a tie around my neck before we went into the water.
And did you also have your hat on?
And I kept my hat on. It had its funny side, because as I said, the destroyers came back after about an hour to pick up survivors, and they had the usual techniques of scrambling necks to help getting the people out of the water, and the crew of the destroyer were down on the nets giving one a hand up. And when I appeared there, I heard a voice from the darkness just above me: "Look here, look what I've got here, a bloody limey," as he thought I'd got an English hat and not an American one.
Were you clinging to wreckage in the sea?
No, I had a life belt which was adequate to support me, and I had my arms to swim with, and the destroyers took up a position such that they drifted down onto us rather than us having to swim after them, being carried away by the wind. So that I was most impressed by the ability and the efficiency with which the Americans handled the situation.
Was the sea rough?
No, calm.
Was it cold?
It's funny you should ask me that, because this is the one question I asked the executive officer of the Northampton. He was abandoning the ship one below me, so to speak, so he got down to the water level before I did, and I found myself asking him, was it cold? One had no option. Also, automatically came the question, was it cold? No, the water was quite pleasantly warm, and the only thing one felt anxious about was that whether any sharks going to come and take off the bottom of one's leg or whatever. So one was anxious to get out of the water as quickly as possible for that reason rather than for any other.
Did you see any?
I saw no shark, no nothing. No.
Was there oil on the water?
Oh yes, the diesel fuel was still burning. Oil fuel was escaping from the oil fuel tanks and being set alight by the burning diesel. So we were a very good bonfire for quite a long time. And I suppose more by luck than good management, we were able to keep on the windward side so that we didn't have this lot being blown down on top of us.
Were any of the seamen caught in the flames?
I think very few, if any. I remember noticing as the ship turned over, she was completely bottom up, and there was a figure, I could see a figure running across the bottom before diving into the sea. And discussing it the next day with the ship's officers, they reckoned they knew who it was, because they knew there was one black chap who was a non-swimmer, and they reckoned it was him who'd held on right until the last minute before he could face plunging into the sea, and he was rescued.
Was there great suction as the ship went down?
I didn't notice it. But by that time I was on board the destroyer, and I certainly I wasn't in a position to notice any action.
Did the captain say anything to you as you were abandoning the ship?
No particular words of wisdom. I think it was, here she goes.
What is it like to see your ship go down?
Well, very different for me than for him. In his case, it was his ship. In my case, it was just the place where I happened to be. So I can understand what his feelings were, but I wasn't in a position to share them at that time.
So you were floating around in a lifebelt with lots of other people surrounding you?
Oh, yes.
Did you speak to each other?
No, one wasted no words, no breaths, should I say. When we got on board the destroyer, there wasn't a great deal of room to do anything because it was the ship's company of 900. Both the destroyers were heavily overladen.
So people, as they were floating about, didn't sing or anything like that to keep their spirits up?
No.
How were you treated aboard the American destroyer?
Very well. They had a problem to deal with. I mean, in a ship normally carrying, shall I say, 120, 150 people, they were saddled with an additional 300, 400, needing food, sustenance, clothing. So they had a lot to cope with. In point of fact, I didn't get any. I had sufficient clothing on to carry on until I could replace it. But most people just had what they stood up in.
I don't suppose you can remember the name of the U.S. destroyer?
Unfortunately, no, I can't. I ought to, but it's gone from my mind.
Do you remember the approximate date when the Northampton went down?
End of November, either the 28th or the 30th of November.
1944?
No, 42, a year after Pearl Harbor.
And this was near Guadalcanal?
That's right, yes.
How far offshore were you, about?
I would guess about 5 miles, 4 or 5 miles. The Japanese destroyers who attacked us would have been fairly close inshore because they were going to disembark troops and arms, and we were to seaward of them. So I think probably about 5 miles.
Did you go back to the British Eastern Fleet after this?
Yes. After I left after the Northampton was removed from me, rather than me being removed from it, I was sent to another American cruiser, the Honolulu, but then received instructions to return to Mombasa. So I did much in reverse, back to Washington. I was debriefed by Admiral Nimitz. When I got to Washington just before Christmas, I found difficulties in getting any further because already people were moving from the States to Casablanca for the Casablanca conference in February. And as a mere commander, I didn't have high priority for a berth in any aircraft going out to Africa. So I had a very comfortable Christmas in Washington, and kept myself occupied by visiting American naval gunnery facilities, Norfolk, Virginia, Cape Cod, and eventually got a flight home from Montreal to England in February 43. Had 3 weeks leave in England, and then flew out back to Mombasa via Lisbon, Libya, Cairo, and then down to Mombasa. And I got there in time to catch the fleet before it sailed back across the Indian Ocean to reopen the naval base in Trincomalee. And the CNC, Admiral Somerville, set up his headquarters in Colombo. And so I came back to a shore-born life, living in the comfortable hotel on the Colombo foreshore, and embarking in the Warspite for operations at sea, of which there were two. One was a bombardment of the harbour at the northern end of Sumatra, and the second on Java, which entailed a 3 or 4 week trip down to northwestern Australia and return. The only particular features I would mention about these operations were that they were international operations, in that the French battleship Richelieu came out to join the fleet, and also the Lexington, American aircraft carrier, also came over and joined this fleet, reopening, shall I say, the Japanese Western Front. For myself, I had two bouts of sickness after my return from America. The usual one in Ceylon is dengue fever, and the other, later on, I had to have my appendix out. So come the middle of 1944, it was suggested I should be relieved and return to UK, which I did, and found myself on my return in November that year appointed as executive officer of the battleship Vanguard being built at John Brown's. And so I finished the war comfortably ensconced in Glasgow.
Did the bombardment of the harbours in the Dutch East Indies occur in 43 or 44?
44, I would guess.
Was there any Japanese opposition?
None.